I'm Susie Larson. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Susie Larson Live.
It's only just a matter of
Susie Larson Live, always honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. So I'm thinking of a word. I'm going to describe it. I want to see if you can guess the word that I'm thinking about. Are you ready? It starts wars. It sabotages dreams. It destroys relationships. It drives and motivates for all the wrong reasons. It gets results, but not the kind that last. It makes people isolate, pull in, and hide. It also makes them step up and lash out. What's the word I'm thinking about? Can you guess? It's shame. Dr. Kurt Thompson joins me today for a fascinating conversation on shame. Title of his book, and it's an older one, it's called The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. Is it possible? I think it's probable that the parts of your narrative, your story that you believe about yourself aren't actually accurate, that you're believing some lies about yourself. As I said, this book is old. Older, a few years older. And I've talked to Dr. Kurt about this numerous times. But as I was digging into it again today, I'm like, this is such a powerful book. I know some people need it. And because it's a backlisted title, we had a tough time getting copies to give away. So you know what I did? I hopped on Amazon and I bought three copies myself for you. So three of you are getting a copy of this book, and it really will lead you, I believe, to places of freedom. So if you want to learn more about shame, about learning to starve shame in your life so that you can move on to a deeper connection with the things of God, with freedom, with who He made you to be, you can text the word book to 877-933-2484. We'll talk with Dr. Kurt about this book, but also he's written some essays recently on COVID and the impact on our heart, our mind, and our perspective. We're going to delve into that as well. A quick announcement. Maybe you've been hearing about it. I'm kind of excited about it, but Faith Radio, partnering with me, my book, Fully Alive, Learning to Flourish, Mind, Body, and Spirit. The premise of the book is this: what happens in our soul happens in our cells. It's all about the physiological impact of shame, of worry, of insecurity, of even selfishness and fear. We're doing an online study and it's free. The thing I just learned today, though, is you've got 3 weeks to sign up, because once the sign-up deadline comes and then we start the study, there'll be no more openings for registration. So you got to do it now. I think we've got 1,400 people signed up. But if you want in on the free online study for this summer, you got 3 more weeks to sign up. Deadline is July 5th. So go to myfaithradio.com. You can sign up. You'll get emails with excerpts from the book and reflection questions. And if you want to get the book, we're offering at a discounted rate just to take it a little bit deeper. But all that information is on the website at myfaithradio.com. All right. Talking about shame today, my guest writes this: no matter the setting, whether it's a retreat I'm leading, a business with which I'm consulting, a conference I'm addressing, or patients I'm sitting with, shame eventually makes its way to the center stage. It simultaneously bends and twists our narratives into painful storylines. Wow, that's amazing. Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Dr. Kurt Thompson is a board-certified psychiatrist and the founder of the Center for Being Known, an organization that develops resources to educate and train leaders on the intersection between interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spiritual formation. He's also the author of Anatomy of the Soul. Dr. Thompson and his wife, Phyllis, a licensed clinical social worker, are the parents of two children. They reside in Arlington, Virginia. As always, it's an honor, Dr. Kurt, to talk with you. Welcome to the program.
Susie, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm really eager for our conversation today.
I am as well. So we love to start every day talking scripture, and I'm wondering if you've been pondering a passage you can share with us.
Well, you know, beginning a little more than a year ago, I started, for the very first time in my life, I've never systematically read through the prophets of the Old Testament. I've dabbled in them. I've read chunks of them here and there, but never really read through them. And so I'm now toward the end of Isaiah. I started with Jeremiah and then Ecclesiastes. I mean, Jeremiah, Lamentations, and Ezekiel. And we're now, I'm sitting in Isaiah, and I'm in the 59th chapter. I've been sitting with this chapter for the last several days. And the very first verse is what jumps off the page at me. This is an entire chapter that in which the prophet is speaking God's words to the people about how their choices of injustice have been the things that have kept him from them, but not because he's not too far away, not because he's not close, but because it literally is what they've kind of wrapped themselves in. The clothing that they have put on has kept them at a distance from him, so to speak. In this first verse, as I read it, "See, the Lord's hand is not too short to save, nor his ear too dull to hear. Rather, your iniquities have been barriers between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear." And it strikes me, I read that verse and I think about our topic today when we talk about shame. I think about the number of, the multitude of ways in which the shame that dwells within me creates in me, and I respond to it by, you know, acting out all kinds of behaviors, micro behaviors, macro behaviors, behaviors toward myself internally, the thoughts that I think about myself, the things I think about other people, and then the actions that I take. And I think about the layers of narrative that I create within myself as a response to shame, narratives that are not true to the gospel. And then I wonder how it is that I feel God's departure. I wonder how it is that I somehow sense his lack of presence. I wonder how it is that I pray and pray, and I still find that there are these ways in which, in times in which I don't sense his presence, and he does seem far away. His arm does seem too short, and his ear does seem deaf to my calling. And it really strikes me, it is an invitation for me, this verse, it's an invitation for me to, I think, really do some house cleaning and do some, you know, some exploration of my own heart and about the narrative that I come to believe be true that actually is often quite opposed to the gospel narrative that I long to be living in the middle of. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's where I've been sitting for the last several days.
I love it. That's exactly why I asked the question. You know, you hear the phrase, hurt people, and you say in the book that shame has this self-reinforcing nature to it. So if you're hurting, and a part of that's embedded in shame, and it's reinforced in the way that you behave, and the story you're telling yourself about your story, you not only hurt yourself, but you are hurting people around you by the very nature of the shame that's sitting in your soul, right?
You're right, and you know I tell people like this. Look, this thing begins at the beginning. I think it's a reason why we look at the foundational texts of our faith. We look at Genesis chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4 through 6, maybe even, and we see that it's no small reason why the writers spoke in the second chapter. The man and the woman were naked, and they were unashamed. Right? It doesn't say that they were unafraid. It doesn't say that they were confident. They may have been all those things, but it speaks to this notion of shame and how we are called as human beings. We were designed, we are made to be like God. We're made to be known, made to be deeply known, and we're made to be known in places and states of vulnerability where shame is absent from that conversation. But we're also made to be deeply known in the presence of others with whom we have great difference. You can't really find differences that are much greater than between men and women. And when you then look at what happens in the next chapter, we see that the very couple that was on the precipice of great creativity, the creativity of great beauty, that necessarily would need to come out of states of vulnerability in the absence of shame, all of that, you know, very, very quickly kind of gets caught up in this whirlpool of shame as the evil one begins to, you know, weave this narrative that basically says God really isn't interested in your playing with his toys. He does not want you to know everything. He does not want you to be all that you can be. He's really telling a story to the woman and to the man in her presence, although he's silent. He really is telling a story of being dismissed. He's telling a story of scarcity. He's telling a story in which love isn't going to be enough for you. And that's a wound. It's a wound to hear that. And I respond to that wound by looking to something else. I respond to it by looking to this tree with this fruit that is so beautiful. It can give me knowledge. It can give me power. It can protect me from a relational interaction. And so I take this fruit, and then we read in the text, and the man and the woman were shown, essentially, that they were naked, right? They don't discover on their own, but they were shown that they were naked. And you wonder, well, how does that happen? And we see already that it's in my shame that I then begin to point out other people's mistakes, other people's shame, other people, you know, I tell you what's wrong with you, and I become your judge and jury. And in this way, I mean, no wonder that they hide themselves from each other. No wonder they then hide themselves from God. And before you know it, I mean, this is the other thing that's important to know about shame, it's not, it, I mean, it is primarily a neurophysiologic event, but it is also primarily, even in the most minor occurrences, it is an act of violence. We experience it as an act of violence to our neuropsychiatric state.
Wow.
I tell people, look, I liken it to, you know, if you were walking around your kitchen and you bump your elbow on the door jamb and, you know, the next day you notice that there's a small bruise there, you wouldn't think anything of it. It was really a minor thing. It's nothing that's really, it's not a big deal. It's just a little bruise. But if you were to look at, you know, the tissue just underneath the surface of the skin, what you would see would you would witness an act of violence. You would see that there had been blood vessels that have been shattered. There had been red blood corpuscles that have been fractured and are all over the place. And the integrity of even that small space of tissue underneath the skin has been violated. Now, it's not that big of a deal because it's just a bruise. But what happens in that minor thing is the same basic process that happens when somebody then hits you in the nose, or when then somebody, you know, kneels on your neck until you can't breathe. Mm. It is out of shame that all acts of violence, all acts of violation emerge, and they begin in the smallest. You know, they begin with bruises. And they end in wars. They begin with the smallest glances. They begin with the tones of voice. And then it becomes systematized. And before you know it, it's not just men against women, which is the oldest fracture line of violence. But it then leads to people groups, like what we now are seeing on our streets. And, you know, I think part of the issue is for us, part of the work of justice in our country is you know, it necessarily includes what we're doing about systemic arrangements of it, where it, you know, is institutionalized. But it's also crucially important that we begin the process of looking at how shame isn't just something that we feel because of our racism. It's actually been the cause of it long before racism ever existed. And we like to say, look, the expressions, the intensity and degree of violence that we express towards someone else is directly proportionate to the degree of shame that we carry within us. And if we don't sense it, if we're not aware of it, it only is because we have accumulated enough coping strategies that keep us essentially neuropsychiatrically immune to its awareness. We are unaware of it. In psychiatry, we call this denial, and we're just pretty good at it. And if we are not doing the hard internal work of our own stories that are not just about racism, but that also precede that, we can do all the kind of work we want to structurally and institutionally. But sooner or later, what's inside of us is going to come back around and find its way out on our streets all over again. It's just going to be a matter of time.
Wow. I'm going to pause here. When we come back, I want to know, Dr. Kurt, how children pick up shame, just sometimes in the most subtle ways, how we pick up shame. I mean, those are extreme examples that have an accumulative effect, and there we've seen it. But as you say, we're all walking around with a measure of shame unless we learn to identify it, and there is a way through it to be healed by it. You're right. Shame is not just a consequence of something Adam and Eve did, but it's an emotional weapon that the enemy uses to corrupt our relationship with God and each other and to disintegrate any and all gifts of vocational vision and creativity. And that's what you want you to see on the other side. God invites us to creativity, to joy, to oneness, to not being our own worst critic, to not coming under the shadow of shame when we don't do it perfectly. We serve a gracious and amazing God. I'm talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson today. The book is titled The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. What's the story that you believe about yourself? We've got three copies to give away. I will tell you, I got them off of Amazon, so they're coming tomorrow. So I'll be sending them out once we get the addresses. But hopefully they're in good shape. I bought them new, so I'm just saying. Text the word book to 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute.
I am healed with the one.
love that song. Thanks for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live, talking to my friend Dr. Kurt Thompson. His book, it's an older book, but it just felt like the time was right that we needed to talk about it now. Plus, Dr. Kurt has written some pretty incredible essays on this COVID crisis, what's happening in our culture. You go to his website, KurtThompsonMD.com. Don't miss it. Great, insightful content. But we got three copies of this book to give away today. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. And Dr. Kurt, you said, to effectively enter into the healing of shame requires that we know the place it holds in our story as a human race. And that requires us to know which story exactly we believe we're living in. And this last line is what struck me so much. To know which story exactly we believe that we're living in. Explain that a bit more.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I'm indebted to some, you know, some really incredible teachers and biblical scholars, one of whom many of your listeners may be aware of, Eugene Peterson, another Leslie Newbegin, another Walter Brueggemann. These are N.T. Wright. These are folks who have formed no small part of what I, you know, how I'm thinking about things. And one of the things that we learn about you know, human like brain and mental development is that nobody ever develops in a vacuum, right? Your brain comes out of the womb with about 20% of its functioning neurons kind of wired together already, kind of ready to do their job. But the other 75 to 80% is going to require some kind of interaction with another human being in order for those neurons to fire appropriately and to come together and grow. So we deeply need other relationships in order for our minds to develop, even biologically. And one of the ways in which those neural networks develop is in the context, you know, we grow up in certain families. And in those families, we have certain narratives that we develop, for instance. So I grew up in an Italian family or a German family, or I grew up in an African-American family, or I grew up in a particular, like I grew up in an evangelical Quaker tradition family where I grew up. And in those places, you know, we hear all kinds of stories. And in my family growing up, you know, I heard the story of the gospel from the time I, you know, they could tote me off to church. And so at one level, I have the gospel story that is being, you know, inculcated into me from the time I'm little. And so the whole notion that I'm loved by God and that Jesus has come to delight in us and has died for our sins, and the whole notion of the gospel is a story that I think I'm living in. So at one level, Susie, I would say I believe that I'm living somewhere between Jesus' resurrection and ascension and his second coming. That's where I think that we're living somewhere in that space. But then, you know, I believe that Jesus is our king, and I believe that you are my sister, and I believe in the new heaven and the new earth, all those kinds of things. But tonight, in my kitchen, it's entirely possible that if I am irritated enough and I lose my temper with my wife or my son, you could stop me and you might ask, Kurt, what story do you believe at this moment? And you discover that at that moment, I don't really believe I'm in the middle of the gospel narrative. I believe I'm in the middle of a story of scarcity. I believe I'm in the middle of a story in which at this moment, if I'm not getting what I want, my needs aren't going to be met. Hmm. What is actually taking place in that moment is that I'm living in kind of like the jet wash of other parts of the story in which I grew up. So sure, I grew up in a house where the gospel was talked about, and we went to church, and all those really good, rich things happened. And there's nothing good about my life that does not have my parents' fingerprints upon it. But my parents were not perfect, and I grew up in a house where, you know, we worked really hard to make sure that we didn't make my dad angry. Now, this is not because my dad was an angry guy. He wasn't. He was never, he never mistreated anybody. He was never abusive. None of it. Like, you'd meet my dad and you'd think he was the salt of the earth. But part of why we, you know, part of why he wasn't an angry guy that we kind of, is because we were working so hard not to make him mad. So what does that mean? Well, that means that at one level, I'm also living in a world, in a story, if you will, in which I believe I got to work really hard to make sure I don't piss people off. And I also had a mom who was the primary, wellspring of spiritual formation in my life, in our family. A woman of prayer, a woman of deep empathy. She taught elementary school for 35 years. You know, for years, you know, she would have students that would come back as adults to talk about how much they loved her as a teacher. This was a woman of God. But she was also a woman who was anxious. She was a woman who was functionally, she was an orphan growing up. And, you know, she was somebody who worried that you don't want to do the wrong thing because, like, you could be abandoned at any minute. Now, these weren't words that she said, but there were some small, subtle things that would just happen at times. And so I also grew up in a world in which you make sure not only that you don't make people angry, but you don't want to make people anxious either. Now, can you imagine? You know, Jesus turns around and says, look, if you can't become like little children, it's going to be tough to enter the kingdom of God. And what does a little child normally healthily do? Gosh, they don't mind making people mad. They're just going to be themselves. They're not going to worry about making you mad or making you anxious. They're just going to be a kid. And they're going to assume that they're living in a world wherein which you, in your loving kindness, will correct them, but will love them in the process, and they don't have to worry about the emotion of anger in the house, and they don't have to worry about the emotion of anxiety in the house. They're just going to learn how to be okay with that. And so many of us, many of your listeners, many of our listeners today will have grown up in homes in which the primary foundational story that they hear maybe from their parents and in their church is like the gospel story. But there is an even more powerful story that they've been living in that they don't even know they've been living in. And those are the stories that we learn through our attachment processes. And our attachment processes teach us the real truth about the world. And so I can hear the gospel, and I can hear about a loving Heavenly Father, but if I haven't had much of an embodied experience with one of those on the real planet Earth, it's going to be tough for me to actually, in a real embodied, viscerally felt way, have a deep sense of what that means when I'm trying to connect with God. And so this is why it's so, and this is where, you know, our topic today about shame. Shame wants to distort our stories. Shame wants to, evil wants to use shame to tell a completely different story. It wants to tell a story. It wants to tell the same story that it was telling the woman and the man in the Garden of Eden, that God is not loving. God does not have your best interest in mind. You do live in a world of scarcity, not in a world of abundance, not in a world of loving kindness. You have a lot to be afraid of. And so
I got to jump here. So sorry, hard break talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson. I told you this is compelling stuff. His book, The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. God invites us to freedom. More great conversation when we come back. You're tuning into Suzy Larson Live. Glad to have you listening today, having a compelling, insightful conversation with Dr. Kurt Thompson. His book, The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. And it's days like this I wish my show was 2 hours, because there's so much we could talk about on his website, KurtThompsonMD.com. He's written some essays on the COVID crisis through the lens of Scripture. And what I want to get to that if we can here. But I just was thinking as you were talking before the break, Dr. Kurt, about some of the ways it shows up. You tell so many stories of clients that you've worked with who are outwardly so successful, so skilled, so talented. Inwardly, they believe they're failures. They're just not enough. And I remember one story of a young girl who brought her 98% score to her mom, and her mom, or 92% score, and her mom says, what happened to the other 8%? And those kinds of comments embedded shame to the point where it was just never enough for her. So let's talk about how those young people grow up into adults and how it shows up in different ways. I'm thinking of people who were maybe raised in a home where you say the gospel is preached, but maybe not the gospel of grace. It's the message of get it right. We do right. We act right. We are going to be right, all for appearance's sake, because we love God and that's what good Christians do. And it compels striving and perfection that's really rooted in shame. So speak to that dynamic.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I think is helpful to bear in mind is that And we try to, you know, we work to teach our patients this as well. I mean, we don't just teach our patients about psychiatry. We talk to our patients about, like, you know, one way to talk about it would be like what our worldview is, or like the story that we believe that we're living in and how we tell that story. And, you know, as it turns out, we live in a world that is largely dominated. The storytelling is like, how do we know that things are true? And that's an important question to ask. How do I know things are true? And the way that I come to know that things are true most powerfully is in our time, in the 21st century, we believe that we know things are true through the scientific method. And you might, your listeners might be thinking, like, why are we talking about this? What's this got to do with anything? Well, what it means is that, you know, when it comes to hearing the gospel and what is true, what this means is that I think things are true as long as I can prove it with an experiment, as long as I can prove it with research, as long as I can logically, linearly know that I know that I know in some kind of abstract way, then I know that it's true. But the difficulty with that is that the way that we most powerfully know things is through the felt experience of life. It'd be like asking, well, how do I know that my wife Phyllis loves me? Well, that's not going to be something I answer by giving you some kind of, like, you know, scientific experiment. And why is any of this important? Well, because we can say to people, you know, here's the gospel story. Jesus came to demonstrate that God is wildly in love with you. We can hear that as a fact. We take that in. We believe that as a story in the same way that I think that, you know, 2 times 6 is 12. But 2 times 6 being 12 doesn't really mean anything to me, except what I need to pass that multiplication test. It doesn't mean anything until I know that there are 6 people in our group that are going on a hike, and it's going to be long enough that we're each getting 2 apples, and I'm buying the apples. How many apples do I need? It means something to me when it has some kind of embodied measurement that makes a difference in terms of what I actually feel and sense and image. And if I don't have relationships, in which I'm being deeply known, in which the things that I am most afraid of and the things I'm most ashamed of, if I don't have relationships in which I'm able to articulate those things, I'm going to carry around my need to cope with all that stuff in my body. And I'm going to work my tail off to be effective, be successful. And I'm going to do that, and I'm also simultaneously going to work really, really hard to make sure that you don't ever see me sweat. And the harder I work and the more successful I become, the more you actually believe that I don't sweat. Because look at him. Look at what he does. Look at how he does it. It's seamless. And then I believe what you believe about me. All the while, my brain is collecting a shame tax. All the while, I'm burning energy that I don't even know that I'm burning, just trying to manage this deeply, viscerally felt sense of I'm not enough. I'm sure that our listeners, many of our listeners, all have had the experience of having the sense of being worried that they will be found out, right? This imposter syndrome, right? I'll never forget, like, you go as a medical student and then even as a resident, even up until the time, I mean, I was in practice for a number of years before I got to a point where I didn't worry about going to a medical conference without feeling like I must be the dullest pencil in the box here. How does that guy who's up there talking about psychopharmacology know so much? I don't know enough. Like, I am just not enough. Shame has a way of, you know, convincing me of this. And so what do? I just work harder. I work harder and harder and harder to convince myself and to convince you and to convince my patients that, like, I have all my stuff together. But the reality is I don't have my stuff together. Nobody does. And here's the thing, Susie. The sooner I'm able to be in a community of people with whom I can tell the truth about how badly I don't have things together, as soon as I'm able to begin to do that, I am no longer burning all the energy that I usually burn to try to keep you believing that I do have my stuff together when I don't. To try to keep me believing that. And when I'm not burning that energy pretending, trying to manage my shame, when I am now deeply connected to, for instance, the two guys that I meet with every Tuesday morning for prayer and confession that I've been meeting with for over 25 years, I mean, I don't go anywhere without them in my head. I don't go anywhere without them in my back pocket. I am not alone. And therefore, I know what it means to, literally, in my chest, I know what it means to feel a little more like what Jesus meant when he said, "And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Because if it is true that we are the body of Christ, that we are Jesus' body, and that if that's not just a metaphor, if that's like the real thing, if this is really who we are, that means that my friends Byron and Jerry, like every Tuesday morning, I see them and I'm looking at Jesus in the room. And when I leave, Jesus goes with me. And he's echoed in Byron and Jerry's voices. And I really believe that there will be a day when a new heaven and new earth dawns. And the three of us will meet with Jesus, and he will point to them and look at me. And he will say to them, "Thank you so much for being me, for Kurt." Wow. And he will look at me and he will say, I really meant it when I said I'm not ever leaving. I really meant it when I said I'm coming for you. I really meant it when I said I'm building a house. I'm building a room. My Father's house has many rooms, and I'm coming for you. And the giving of the Holy Spirit and his weaving together my body in the faces and voices and bodies of your friends, that's the down payment that St. Paul talks about. That's the down payment on the house that I'm getting ready. And I'm coming for you. And shame's not going to have any part of the conversation.
Dear Lord. Kurt, I remember one of the times I had you on the show, and you said one of the reasons that Jesus says, "Fix your eyes, you know, on what you cannot see," want to fix our eyes on Jesus, is so that we would see that his eyes are fixed on us. And I've never forgotten that. We have no shame keeps us from understanding his incredible affection for us. And that's necessary for healing of the soul, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's like, I mean, we don't have a substitute. When I'm thirsty, I don't have a substitute for water. I mean, I can drink a Mountain Dew. I like that. But, you know, 99% of Mountain Dew is water. 98% of milk is water. When I'm thirsty, there isn't a substitute. I need water. And with shame, there, you know, for its healing, there isn't a substitute. We need the gaze of other people.
Yeah.
We need to see Jesus seeing us and hearing us and speaking to us. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that's, I was going to say another thing that you'd said, one of our interviews is you need to be able to be with people, have a group, small group in your life where you can be as raw as you are and they don't leave the room. We're going to pause here when we come back. I mean, think about that. I pray that for each and every one of you, that you would have a core group of people who, like Dr. Kurt's friends, who are leaning in, who are listening to your story, who are not getting up and walking out. They're leaning in and affirming the gift of God in you, on you. When we come back, Dr. Kurt, I want to talk about these people that you described, that you've worked with and walked with, who've been courageously engaging their stories, moving to greater places of depth with God, things that you've noticed about their stories. I pulled out some bullets from the book. Like, one of them is they've realized what it means to pay attention to what they pay attention to. So we're going to kind of cast a vision for some of the things that were just common denominators, character focuses in some of these folks who found their way out of shame and into love, to being known and to knowing the love of God. Talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson, what an incredible conversation. We'll be back in a minute.
Oh, my soul seems you are.
Thanks for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live, talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson. His book, it's an older one, just felt so strongly that it was a message we needed to hear today, The Soul of Shame, retelling the stories we believe about ourselves. We've got three copies to give away. If you want to text the word book to get in the drawing, text it to 877-933-2484. And as I said before the break, I just love the section in the book where you describe these people you've worked with, clients or patients that you've walked through, and you've seen them courageously engage their stories, and they move to greater places of depth and connection with God and with others. And you just notice some common denominators about them. One, the first one was that they've realized what it means to pay attention to what they pay attention to. Say more, if you would.
Well, I think one thing in general, too, Susie, that I would say is that there's always a, you know, we are rhythmic people. And by that, I mean, you know, we are people of rhythm in every way you can possibly imagine. We have rhythmic heartbeats. We have rhythmic pulmonary function. We have a rhythmic gait, if you will. We live on a rhythmic world that spins every 24 hours, tides, migration patterns. We're rhythmic. We have been created in rhythmic fashion. And I say that because life, you know, the generation of life, you know, the fullness of life is something that we do both in solitude. So there's work for me to do, for Kurt to do, that only Kurt can do. And then there is work that Kurt must necessarily do in the context of a community. And that community work then gets me ready to go back and do work in solitude that I then bring back to work on in the community and so forth. And so I would say, for instance, when it comes to this question of how well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to, that's a great question. And because we say that attention, the attentional mechanism of the mind, is like the ignition key in a car. It starts the engine. Everything that we do, every choice we make, every action we take, is the product of a shift in our attention from one thing to another. And so most of our trouble in life is hitched to the reality that we aren't paying very close attention to what we are paying attention to. And so our attention moves, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily, from one thing to the next to the next. And it's just going so automatically that I don't know that it's doing that. And before you know it, I'm in a depression spiral or I'm getting panicked. And I think that, well, this has just happened to me without me actually being aware that it is happening with my cooperation based primarily on the degree and manner in which I'm turning my attention to certain things. So I have work to do internally, and we actually give patients exercises to do that strengthen, sharpen, and strengthen their awareness that they are like have the capacity to pay attention to things, and when their attention is drifting from one thing to the next. For example, one of the things that we ask people frequently in the work that we do is, it's a simple question: what are you feeling? What are you feeling? And we educate patients that when we ask that question, what are you feeling? I'm not asking what you're thinking. I'm asking for you to describe an emotion that you are, you know, that you're experiencing. What emotion is being evoked? Many times, people, it doesn't matter how much we've educated about this, they'll say, well, I'm thinking, and they just go on and give me their thoughts, but I'm not actually interested in their thoughts. And so even there, I'm still like, I'm curious about what you're paying attention to when I ask you the question, what are you feeling? Moreover, we push that a little farther, and we will say, not only what do you feel, let's say, well, I think I feel confused, or I think I feel afraid. The next question we will ask is, where in your body do you feel it? Now, here's an interesting question, because asking where I sense something, where I sense my fear, and people will say, I feel it in my chest, or I feel it in my fists as they're being clenched. You see, if I'm not aware of how emotion is being regulated and distributed in my physicality, if I'm not aware of that, there's a lot that I actually could do but that I never do because I'm not paying attention to how my emotion is showing up. As I do this within myself, I can say, oh my gosh, I'm clearly feeling tense and I'm breathing more shallowly and more quickly. And what can that mean? I can say, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to pause and I'm going to take two deep breaths and I am going to, on purpose, begin to breathe more deeply and more slowly. And you might be surprised to see how what you are feeling, I was feeling worried and afraid, and now I'm actually feeling calmer. because I'm actually choosing to take a physical action that helps regulate my emotion. And so when Paul says in 1 Corinthians that therefore we take every thought captive, he's talking not just about my cognition, not just about the thoughts that I think. For Paul, every thought would have included every mental activity that we know of, which includes, as we now know with neuroscience, we would say that also includes the connection of my mind to my body. Taking every thought captive then means I not only am aware that I'm feeling anxious, I become aware of how it's translated into my breathing, and I slow my breathing down. And now, instead of yelling at my child, I calmly can ask them questions because I'm doing the work of regulating this. But I don't do this very well on my own. If I've never done this before, this is really difficult for me to do this on my own. But I will tell you what I can do. When I am working with someone and someone is listening to me, and that person has me say, well, tell me, what are you feeling? Where are you feeling it? If I have somebody else's brain in the room assisting me in paying attention to what I'm paying attention to, they become an external brain that helps my brain get stronger at doing this. One of the things that we're doing more and more in our practice is we're running what we call confessional communities. We're developing confessional communities. These are groups in which we are helping other people tell their stories collectively together in a group of 6 or 8 other people, men and women together. And when all of this emotion and story floods into the room, the beautiful thing about this, Susie, is what happens when one of those members in the community is surrounded by other people who might be feeling things too, but they are saying to them effectively, I know that you're ashamed. I know that you're afraid. I know that you are fill in the blank, and we see it in your face. We see you wanting to get up and leave the room. We're not leaving the room because we want to be here with you. Even in this moment when you feel the stuff that you hate the most about yourself, we want to be in the room with you. And so this attentional mechanism now becomes a thing that we don't just do on our own, but that we learn to strengthen collectively in the presence of the group. And this becomes one of those examples of how we move rhythmically, both from the place of solitude to a place of community in doing this kind of work.
Wow, that is just powerful. Another common attribute that you've noticed in the patients you've worked with as they've journeyed through and away from shame and toward wholeness and healing is they learn that memory is as much about predicting the future as it is about recalling the past. So your narrative about your past has a lot to do with where you're going in the future. Say a bit more, if you would, about that.
Well, we think it's really important for people to name the story that they believe that they are in, as we've said earlier. What's the story that you believe you're living in? And that necessarily requires us to actually do some homework. It requires me to do some narration of that. I need to go back and journal about that. We give people the assignment of taking each decade at a time. I want you to write it out, what you remember. Write out those things that are emotionally salient for you, that are parts of your story, of your family, the things that were traumatic, the things that brought you joy, so forth and so on. And then we're going to invite you to tell that story in the group. And it is striking. One of the things that we learn from folks is that, you know, it is important when a person is telling their story, it's not just the content. It's not just what they tell, but how they tell it. If I give you 20 minutes to tell your story and you're a 45-year-old guy and you take 15 of those minutes to talk about the first 10 years of your life, but you're left with 5 minutes to talk about the last 35 years of your life, that tells us something about how you pay attention to your narrative. And that narrative that I walk around with in the back of my head is the thing that projects onto my future. The memory that I have of how life has worked for me so far is the memory that I use to anticipate what the future is going to be like. And if I have grown up in a world in which I believe that I have to, as I was saying earlier about my own story, if I believe that I live in a world because of my own past, that I now have to manage everybody else's anger and manage everybody else's anxiety, that's going to be a lot of work that I'm going to have to do going forward into the future. But what happens if I'm working in a community in which they say, well, tell us about what you think about, not just about your own life outside the group, but what about what you're feeling right now in the room between you and George or Sarah or Bill or Hadley or whoever? I'm now no longer going to be working out my memory in some distant future outside this community. I'm going to work it out right now. And so one of the questions that we ask patients about frequently in these communities, when they say, well, I'm afraid to say this, or I'm afraid things might happen, we say, tell us the story that you think is going to happen, not just about in your life with your spouse or your kids or your job outside. Tell us what you think is going to happen right here, right now. If you were to say to Sarah exactly what you're thinking, what do you think she's going to do? What, like, in your mind, what's the story that comes up? And of course, people are afraid to say these things. But then they do, because everybody's doing this work. And then we say, well, why don't you check with Sarah to see if that's exactly how she's going to respond, the way that you're afraid she's going to respond. And they check with Sarah, and Sarah says, that couldn't be further from the truth. I adore you. I'm glad to be in the room with you. I don't think that you're an idiot. I don't think, you know, that, like, I want to be in the room with you. And to have a person have their memory and their anticipated future confronted by grace.
Wow.
By a kind voice, by body language that is soft and at ease, by, you know, by facial expression of kindness, right? Of eye contact that is warm. Like, that's the experience that changes people's lives. That's what touches a person's right hemispheric activity that changes the nature of the story that they believe they're living in. Because it is now no longer just a script that they read in some Bible storybook. It is now a lived, breathed, physically engaged and experienced moment in real time and space. And it's in that space that we would say, because you're now going to pay attention to this moment in which you've had a transformational moment with Sarah. And here's then what we're going to do. We're going to give you, let's say, George, we're going to give you the assignment that when between now and next week, when this group reconvenes, every single day, twice a day, we want you to take 5 minutes, close your eyes, and we want you to replay what just happened here in the room. We want you to remember what it was like to hear Sarah say, I adore you. I love being in the room with you. And we want you to pay attention to what you feel and where you feel it in your body. And we want you to hear what it was like that when she said that, Eric, sitting to your left, leaned in and said, man, I feel the same way about you. I would never want you to think that I wouldn't want you in the room. And George, we want you to practice this. Practice, 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 practice. And we want you now to pay attention, not to a fact, but to this remembered experience. And in this way, Susie, this becomes the same kind of practice that you do if you want to become a really good pianist. If you want to play the piano really well, you're going to practice, 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 but you don't practice thinking about it. You practice with the piano. And before it's all said and done, you don't play the piano plays you.
Got to jump in. Oh, my goodness. This is amazing. Dr. Kurt Thompson, I told you this would be. I just think it was a word in due season. I pray you found some encouragement here. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Susie Larson Live. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, and never miss a show.